So welcome. We are now in chapter 9 of the story. I just wanted to start by actually looking back a little bit. I sometimes come across these comics. This was pretty recently published, and so this is just the comic. This doesn't have anything to do with today. But you see, it's the first editor. Why don't we start with these first 10 and see how it goes? So that's just a Moses joke. From October 27th. But the quote I want to start us with today is from Ellen Davis, because I think this will help guide what we're doing today. And she writes this: "Movies and television, even modern novels, have taught us to expect dramatic scene painting, psychological probing, explosive exchanges. But the Bible tells a story like Rembrandt etches one. You have to slow down and look closely to see much of anything at all, and then let your heart dwell on what you see." So I think it's that encouragement to slow down that is a helpful word for many of us, maybe all of us, most likely for people in our lives as well, that there is value in slowing down and not just seeking to rush through everything to get to the next thing. That's part of the gift of discernment God gives us as well. We get to decide. You know, God trusts that we can decide what's actually important and what may not be. And so today, as we enter the book of Ruth, I think it'll serve as a bit of a palate cleanser for us after the last few weeks. You know, we're not... We don't have to deal with all the judges again this week. We'll talk a little bit about them, but for a different reason than you dealt with them last week. And hopefully you see today and this week as an opportunity for us to luxuriate in a single story. I think this is the first week among all of the weeks where we just have one story in front of us. And that's one of the gifts of a book like Ruth, that it's this self-contained narrative. And so another quote to center us today as we engage Ruth, and as we try to do it, our engagement today slowly and deeply to unpack the richness of this book. So this is from Yaira Amit, who writes, "It seems to me that reading a biblical story is like observing a polished gem. And the more you examine it from various angles, the more you are captivated by the many facets of its brilliance." And so today, what I'd like to have us do, or what I'll do is give us a framework that we'll put into practice today. I'll offer it in our teaching time together. And in your small groups, you can do more of this as well. It works well for the book of Ruth, but it's also some ways of engaging any story of the Bible, and specifically as we're looking through the Old Testament stories. Ruth is nice because it's a clearly defined story. So we know Ruth 1 through Ruth 4, that's the entirety of the book, can be a single story. And so you can identify other stories throughout the Old Testament and use these same techniques. So what I'm going to offer is actually something from my friend Eric Seibert, who wrote a book called Enjoying the Old Testament. And the subtitle is A Creative Guide to Encountering Scripture. So the title of the book is there on your handout. And so in a section that he has titled, get this, after these past few weeks, Having Fun with the Old Testament. That's a pretty audacious claim, right? But one of the things he talks about is exploring new meaning in old stories. Exploring new meaning in old stories. And the three ways to do that, or three techniques that we will engage, or things to actually pay attention to, because these are realities of many Old Testament texts that we'll see in the book of Ruth and hopefully apply in other stories as we move forward. And the three pieces are repetition, naming, and what he calls the functional significance of personal details. So we'll unpack what that one means. But for the first one, repetition, is when you read stories, Maybe there'll be times, and this is particularly true if you're just reading straight from the Bible, the story itself, for all the things it does well, the reason it reads more concisely is that it removes a bunch of the repetition just so the flow works narratively. But in the biblical text, the Old Testament authors and editors have a lot of instances where there's repetition that a current editor would be like, no, you just said that, don't say it again. And then why are you saying it again? We'll get to that. Or don't you have a thesaurus? So things like that, that for us, it doesn't make sense. It seems clunky, but there's actually a reason why it happens. So a couple instances are Samson's birth. I'm not going to deal a lot with Samson again. You could deal with him last week. But I will use that as an instance. And then next week, another time that it will happen is Samuel's warning about kings in 1 Samuel chapter 8. So what this means, so one instance in Judges 13, this is just an A-B comparison. And so I know it's small on the screen, but that's simply because so you can see what's going on here. So this is picking it up in Judges 13, verse 3. This is, I'll just read that, the left-hand column. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman who would become Samson's mother, and said to her, although you are barren, having borne no children, which then there's a redundancy there, but there's a reason why. So it's emphasizing that her barrenness. You shall conceive and bear a son. Now be careful not to drink wine or strong drink or to eat anything unclean, for you shall conceive and bear a son. No razor is to come on his head, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from birth. It is he who shall begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. All right, that's the message that the angel gives to Samson's mom. She goes to relay the message in the very next verse. So listen to the repetition, and you can do the A-B comparison and see. So I would like you to pay attention to what's missing, what's different in this repetition of the same story. Then the woman came and told her husband, a man of God came to me, and his appearance was like that of an angel of God, most awe-inspiring. I did not ask him where he came from, and he did not tell me his name, but he said to me, you shall conceive and bear a son. So then drink no wine or strong drink and eat nothing unclean, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from birth to the day of his death. Did you notice what's missing?
The razor.
There's no razor is to come on his head. And if we pay attention to that repetition and see that it's missing, that's a clue that later on, that's a very significant part of Samson. It causes the downfall of Samson. And so in this repetition, although it feels clunky and be like, we just read that, in that repetition, it's a literary device used to say, pay attention to that detail. It's an important detail. But that's something we can only do when we slow down and pay attention to the text like that. So another thing is naming. So that's another piece. So Cain and Abel, for instance. So a story we've covered several weeks ago, but in Genesis 4, verses 8 through 10. Now pay attention. Cain said to his brother Abel, let us go out to the field. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. So notice that Abel is consistently referred to as his brother Abel. His brother Abel, which is emphasizing that, yes, you are in fact your brother's keeper. And paying attention to how people are named, both what the names mean, but then also how they are named or described. So Bathsheba coming up is described often as the wife of Uriah, the wife of Uriah, the wife of, which is to emphasize the fact that David is committing adultery. So in this case, it's to say, Abel is your brother, and Cain, you are your brother's keeper. So again, those details. So it's kind of like, so we have a dog, and it's very much my wife's dog. I like our dog just fine, but he's our wife's dog. We, you know, she loves dogs, and the dog, oh, this dog loves her the way I would hope I could love the Lord someday. And our dog has this habit. I won't say that it's nurtured by my spouse, but you know, he doesn't mind digging through you know, the trash bins in the and digging out tissues and stuff like that. And so his name's Hamilton. And so if I find the, you know, he's gone into the bathroom and there's, you know, tissue strewn on the floor or whatever, Karen would hear it much differently if I say, well, Hamilton got into the trash. Or if I said, your dog got into the trash. But that's what the Old Testament does time and again with this naming device. I mean, we pay attention to how people are named. And then that last, the last one that Seibert puts in front of us, functional significance of personal details, which is to say, in the Bible, most characters' physical traits are never described. Like, this is true in the New Testament as well. Like, we are never told what Jesus looks like. We don't know how tall he was. We don't know how long his hair was, the color of, you know, we can make assumptions kind of knowing, but we really don't know because it's not, it doesn't have functional significance. Those details are only shared if it's a part of the story. So for instance, Esau is described in Genesis 25 as a hairy man. Well, interesting. That's not usually described, but there's a reason for it. It's because come Genesis 27, when Jacob and Rachel are trying to fool Isaac, he dresses up in the skin because he needs to be hairy like his brother. So that's why it's important. Or last week, again, Judges, we have Ehud, who is described as left-handed because, you know, the stake, and then Eglon, who's described as very fat because when you drive the stake in and then, you know, I don't know what the sound is. We need a Foley. It's gross, but it's a gross story, so I don't know. So those details are important. That, like, the left-handed is an important detail because it means you do things opposite and so on. So that's just paying attention. And again, we'll get to all three of these things in the book of Ruth. So like I said, we're going to, you know, kind of slow walk through Ruth as we just enjoy this incredible story. So I'm just going to start, and I'm going to, just because it makes sense with something that's coming later, the translation I'm reading from is the Common English Bible. It's a newer translation. It's 2011, but it's not like 1611 when the King James Version was first published. But anyway, I'll read from this one, and I'll just read from Ruth 1. I start and then I stop. So start paying attention to the naming, repetition, and what are the personal details that you hear that may have a functional significance or a purpose. So as you read or hear these words, just try to think through how those techniques of reading, that framework, could help. During the days when the judges ruled, so there you go, we're in the same time frame as last week, there was a famine in the land. A man with his wife and two sons went from Bethlehem of Judah to dwell in the territory of Moab. The name of that man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They entered the territory of Moab and settled there. But Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. Then only she was left along with her two sons. They took wives for themselves, Moabite women. The name of the first was Orpah, and the name of the second was Ruth. And they lived there for about 10 years. But both of the sons, Mahlon and Chilion, also died. Only the woman was left, without her two children and without her husband. Then she arose along with her daughters-in-law to return from the field of Moab, because while in the territory of Moab, she had heard that the Lord had paid attention to his people by providing food for them. She left the place where she had been, and her two daughters-in-law went with her. They went along the road to return to the land of Judah. Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, "Go, turn back, each of you, to the household of your mother. May the Lord deal faithfully with you, just as you have done with the dead and with me. May the Lord provide for you so that you may find security, each woman in the household of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. But they replied to her, "No. Instead, we will return with you to your people." Naomi replied, "Turn back, my daughters. Why would you go with me? Will there again be sons in my womb that they would be husbands for you? Turn back, my daughters. Go. I am too old for a husband. If I were to say that I have hope, even if I had a husband tonight, and even more, if I were to bear sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you refrain from having a husband? No, my daughters. This is more bitter for me than for you, since the Lord's will has come out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth stayed with her. Naomi said, "Look, your sister-in-law is returning to her people and to her gods. Turn back after your sister-in-law." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to abandon you, to turn back from leaving you, from following you. Wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do this to me and more so if even death separates me from you." When Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her about it. So both of them went along until they arrived at Bethlehem. When they arrived at Bethlehem, the whole town was excited on account of them, and the women of the town asked, "Can this be Naomi?" She replied to them, "Don't call me Naomi, but call me Mara, for the Almighty has made me very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has returned me empty. Why would you call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has deemed me guilty?" Thus Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, returned with her from the territory of Moab. They lived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So one thing that's good to know is that the Moabites and the Israelites were enemies. There's a history of this. It's in the book of Numbers, later in the book of Nehemiah, about the enmity between the Moabites and the Israelites. So that's important to note in this. As it comes to naming, and you've got that on your sheet, just kind of the different names, it's interesting, of course, first of all, that Bethlehem means house of bread. So the story starts with a famine in the house of bread, which is an interesting detail. It's ironic that that would be the case. Elimelech, Naomi's husband, his name means God is my king. Which is the shortened version of Elohim, which means translated as God, and Melech is king, so God is my king. That's the name of Naomi's husband. Now, this is also where we can have fun with the story, because to the original audience, there weren't a whole lot of surprises about what was happening to Naomi and Elimelech's sons. Because Mahlon, the first son, that name means decaying or sickly. All right? So, Kilian's name means dying or frail. So if their sons are named decaying and dying, we're not super surprised that they don't last long in the story. And Naomi's name means pleasant. There are other names in the chapter as well. One name is Orpah. Orpah can mean back of neck, gazelle, or the one who walks away? Which is tied to that back of neck, because if someone walks away, you see the back of their neck. Ruth means compassion for the misery of another, or compassionate friend, or beloved. So there's meaning to her name. And Naomi, even in changing her name, rather spitefully, we see, says, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Lord has dealt bitterly with me." So, and Mara means bitter. Interestingly, maybe you caught this, another ironic thing. So if there's a famine in the house of bread, when we pay attention to the details, she said, "I went away full, but the Lord has returned me empty." But if you look at the scene, Naomi is returning with Ruth. So is Naomi correct that the Lord has, in fact, returned her empty? Just another FYI, it's there. Boaz, we get introduced to him very shortly, means strength or swiftness. And then here's just a fascinating other piece about naming. That the way that in verses 20 and 21, that the author of the book of Ruth describes God. So what gets translated as the Lord, and in Old Testament translations, it'll always be the small caps, so L with the small caps, is Yahweh, and that's kind of the unpronounceable name. I think you've heard about that in the past week. So the Lord, that one's very straightforward, Yahweh. But here, the other name that God is given is the Almighty. And we hear that so often that we kind of shrug that off to say, okay, yeah, that makes sense. We hear it all the time. We sing it all the time, and we see it in these translations all the time. So the word, though, that gets described here is El Shaddai. That's El Shaddai. If you were an Amy Grant fan, my great aunt was a big Amy Grant fan, so I remember hearing El Shaddai, I think in about 1983, and she had that song. But El Shaddai is a word that there are at least seven different kind of root possible meanings. Almighty is one of them. But the way that Almighty got settled on was Jerome was translating what became known as the Vulgate. If you've heard of the Vulgate of St. Jerome, that's the Latin translation of the Bible. And in the Old Testament, what Jerome was using was the Septuagint, which was the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. So original Hebrew texts translated into Greek that Jerome was translating into Latin. All right, so there's several steps along the way to arrive at the Vulgate of St. Jerome. Our English translations, any good English translation, works as closely with the original texts translating those languages into English rather than going through those steps. Jerome was doing this. The project took him a couple decades, from about 383 to 404. He was living in the time of the of Rome when, you know, it was Constantinian Rome and the Roman Empire was there. Jerome was a single, celibate man. So if you think about that, a single, celibate man in a place where the church has been accorded a place right alongside the empire, and he has seven different options of how to translate this word El Shaddai, he chooses Almighty. It's worth noting some other possible translations would be mountain protection or mountain protector. So that's another kind of root possibility of that word El Shaddai. And then related to that, another one that's a possible or that also is in existence is fertile country. Or perhaps more literally in the Hebrew, the word shed means well-breasted one. Well-breasted one. So if you think about what the breasts of a nursing mother does, or do, I guess. Let me get my subject and verb straight. That's another way of seeing El Shaddai. Jerome, the single celibate man living in the midst of the Roman Empire after Constantine, believe it or not, did not choose that image of God to translate El Shaddai. So it's just worth keeping in mind that this imagery, this feminine imagery of God, this female imagery of God is right there. And so when you hear Almighty, you could also think well-breasted one. You think about the nurture, the support, the love that comes through God. Or that mountain protector. I mean, protection and nurture. That's what good moms do. I would hope God is a good mom. So, that's kind of where we can get with naming and paying attention to the names in the story. So repetition, you heard turn back or go back three times through verses 8 and 12. Ruth uses the phrase turn back in verse 16. Then the people say they came back in verse 22. So that's just another way that repetition. So, and the chapter is also bookended with Bethlehem and Moab. And so just paying attention. And sometimes just reading aloud, we hear things, our ear catches things in ways that our eyes don't. So just that's kind of a small thing. Not every time there's a lot of repetition doesn't necessarily have a ton of deep meaning, but it can also be a signifier to say, well, hey, there's something to pay attention to. There's something to pay attention to. Then we get to Ruth 2. And I'll just read a little bit at the start of Ruth chapter 2. Now Naomi had a respected relative, a man of worth, through her husband from the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field so that I may glean among the ears of grain behind someone in whose eyes I might find favor." Naomi replied to her, "Go, my daughter." So she went. She arrived and she gleaned in the field behind the harvesters. By chance, it happened to be the portion of the field that belonged to Boaz, who was from the family of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem. He said to the harvesters, "May the Lord be with you." And they said to him, "May the Lord bless you." Boaz said to his young man, the one who was overseeing the harvesters, "To whom does this young woman belong?" The young man who was overseeing the harvesters answered, "She's a young Moabite woman, the one who returned with Naomi from the territory of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean so that I might gather up grain from among the bundles behind the harvesters.' She arrived and has been on her feet from the morning until now and has sat down only for a moment." Boaz said to Ruth, "Haven't you understood, my daughter? Don't go glean in another field. Don't go anywhere else. Instead, stay here with my young women. Keep your eyes on the field. Keep your eyes on the field that they are harvesting and go along after them. I've ordered the young men not to assault you. Whenever you are thirsty, go to the jugs and drink from what the young men have filled." So that's the first 9 verses of Ruth 2. So just to unpack a little bit about what we heard and then what comes later in this chapter as well. A naming piece is how Ruth is described. So in 1:15, there's this your sister-in-law relationship that's emphasized with Orpah and Ruth. But then in chapter 2, Naomi refers to Ruth as my daughter. So there's perhaps a shift there, because also in Ruth 1, Orpah and Ruth were described as my daughters-in-law, and here it's my daughter. She refers to Ruth as her daughter in verse 2, in verse 16, and verse 18. Interestingly, in verse 8, Boaz also calls Ruth my daughter, perhaps a little different meaning of daughter as things will turn out, but he does that a couple times. So functional significance part, you probably heard Ruth was described as a young woman in verse 5 of chapter 2. So a young woman. And we compare that to what Naomi describes herself in verse 11 of chapter 1 when she says, "Will there ever be sons in my womb that they will be husbands for you?" And Naomi emphasizes in the first chapter her age to say that she won't be able to bear sons. And so then as a contrast, we have Ruth described as a young woman. Then just another piece that's a way, not for these three parts of naming, repetition, and functional significance, but just a way for us to see the details of the Old Testament working together or in conversation with one another, is this Old Testament tradition of gleaning. So it's mentioned there. We heard about it in chapter 2 a little bit. It comes back up because that's what Ruth is doing. And that comes from Leviticus and from Deuteronomy, this gleaning tradition. So Deuteronomy 24, verse 19 says this: "When you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be left for the alien, the orphan, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all your undertakings." So this is a way that God built into the way that the harvest was done, care for those who lived on the margins. And so we see Boaz and his crew living this out by leaving the gleanings for the foreigners, orphans, and widows. And Ruth actually happens to be two of those. We don't know if she would be considered an orphan. So anyway, so it's just a way to point to Boaz's faithfulness and then to see where, the original hearers would know the gleaning tradition and would know that this is a sign of Boaz being faithful and Boaz's people being faithful. Also, you probably heard, maybe your ears even perked up, in Ruth 2, verse 9, when Boaz tells Ruth, "I've ordered the young men not to assault you," which is important. Remember, this is a patriarchal society, and so women were seen as property, and so and as objects by so many. But here we have Boaz saying, "I've ordered the young men." So he institutes an anti-sexual harassment policy in Ruth chapter 2. So there's a long history of anti-sexual harassment policy here. So, but anyway, those are the sorts of things that we can note. Then the rest of Ruth 2 goes through this story of Ruth becoming acquainted there, and then Naomi eventually pointing Ruth to say, "All right, now here's what you do next." So we'll skip ahead then to Ruth chapter 3. And I'll just read a little bit of that. I'll start at verse 1. Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to Ruth, "My daughter, shouldn't I seek security for you so that things might go well for you? Now isn't Boaz, whose young women you were with, our relative? Tonight he'll be winnowing barley at the threshing floor. You should bathe, put on some perfume, wear nice clothes, and then go down to the threshing floor. Don't make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, notice the place where he is lying, then go uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." Then Ruth replied to her, "I'll do everything you're telling me." So she went down to the threshing floor, and she did everything just as her mother-in-law had ordered. Boaz ate and drank, and he was in a good mood. He went over to lie down by the edge of the grain pile. There she quietly approached, uncovered his legs, and lay down. During the middle of the night, the man shuddered and turned over, and there was a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. She replied, "I'm Ruth, your servant. Spread out your robe over your servant, because you are a redeemer." He said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have acted even more faithfully than you did at first. You haven't gone after rich or poor young men. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I'll do for you everything you are asking. Indeed, my people, all who are at the gate, know that you are a woman of worth. Now, although it's certainly true that I'm a redeemer, there's a redeemer who is a closer relative than I am. Stay the night, and in the morning, if he'll redeem you, good, let him redeem. But if he doesn't want to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I myself will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. So she lay down at his feet until morning. So, lie down or laying, that gets repeated 8 times in verses 4 through 14. So there's clearly a repetition that is going on in that phrase. And then I think it's worth just noting, because we do not have perhaps deeply Jewish sensibilities to understand a lot of those ancient concepts, but then kind of the playfulness that's knit into these stories, because for so many of us, and it comes, we have a very well-intentioned piety to read biblical stories and take it as absolutely and utterly seriously as we can. But I also don't want to miss the fun that's knit into the text, or possibly knit into the text either, because there's puns and innuendos and euphemisms all throughout chapter 3 of Ruth. So I'm going to share with you, this isn't mine, but this is the work of scholars much better versed than I. And then also, I'm sharing the scholars' words so you don't get mad at me for what they're saying. So this is in a study note of the New Interpreter's Study Bible, one of the absolute best study Bibles. So if you want to get a great study Bible, the New Interpreter's Study Bible, absolutely incredible. And so I'll just read this little excursus they offer on chapter 3 of Ruth about the puns and innuendos in this chapter. In chapter 3, the narrator uses a series of puns that can have either innocent or sexually suggestive meanings. We understand what that's like or what that's about. That's actually, while not necessarily sexually suggestive, that's why a lot of Disney movies, or especially Pixar movies, are so popular, because they function at 2 different levels. Because kids can get in and it's fun, but then there are things knit into that we hear at an adult level. It doesn't ruin it for the kids, but that deepens the experience rather than just being, oh, that's kids. So it's not Barney the Purple Dinosaur, but it's Toy Story. So we hear about the longing and loss that's in the story, while the kids can be interested in the action that's going on. So we kind of understand how that works. But in Ruth, what it's working is innocent or sexually suggestive meanings. I continue. The Hebrew word shakab, lie down, is used 8 times in verses 3, 4 through 14, like I noted. Shakab can simply mean sleep, but the word is also frequently used in biblical texts to imply sexual intercourse, multiple times in the book of Genesis. Similarly, the word galah, uncover, is frequently found in texts that prohibit incest. So that's another way. So in Leviticus, it's referred to. Regalion, which is feet or lower body, is a common euphemism for the genitals. That's in Deuteronomy 28, Isaiah 7, and Ezekiel 16. So uncover his feet. Okay. Now don't get mad at me. This is simply saying there's a richness here. So let's not get a... It's really interesting. How many of us see violence depicted in movies and kind of shrug and be, it's okay? We see sex depicted in movies and be like, hide the kids. And I'm not making blanket statement, but I just think it's... I wonder if we're so skittish about our own sexual ethics that it's our piety prohibits us from seeing the gifts that God has given us in our embodied realities. It's what I tell the 9th graders every year, because we talk about human sexuality. Be like, if it weren't for parents having sex, you wouldn't be, and that creeps them out, because they don't want to think about that. But it's true for all of us. And so that, just, think through that. So that's, the uncovering the feet. And threshing floors were traditionally associated with sex for hire. So like, we have a red light district. We know what that means. You don't have to say more. threshing floors. So, you know, the verb yada, make known, observe, or know, is also used in Old Testament texts as a euphemism for sexual activity. When Ruth asks Boaz to spread your cloak over your servant, she uses a phrase that has sexual overtones in Deuteronomy 27:20 and Ezekiel 16:8. Thus, while the narrator does not spell out for us what happened between midnight and morning, the language used throughout the chapter is both ambiguous and sexually suggestive. You can take it either way. What would be interesting is why you would choose which way to take it. Just to uncover that, to hold up the mirror to ourselves. So anyway, and then they say, even if nothing more happened between Ruth and Boaz than the conversation reported in chapter 3, verses 8 through 13, Ruth's behavior, coming to the threshing floor, lying next to a sleeping man who is not her husband, would undoubtedly have been scandalous according to the standards of the society in which she lived. Her behavior fits smoothly into the patterns of stories told in the Bible about the women who contributed to the line of David. Okay. Yeah, and that's where it's complicated as well, because I think, I mean, the other things are paying attention to the dynamics with Ruth and Boaz. So, you know, you could either see Naomi as being manipulative, even like Rachel was with Jacob, or what that means, or that Naomi is trying to equip Ruth to navigate as a foreigner in a place and a culture that would be predisposed to reject her. So, I mean, there's a lot of shades of gray. And if we just want it black and white to say this is good and this is bad, the Bible is not really the place to look. And so there's a lot of that going on. So we're gonna get to the end here very quickly. And so then what you already heard throughout those verses I read in chapter 3, the word redeem or redeemer kept coming up. If you read through the rest of chapter 3 and into chapter 4, and that's why I chose the Common English Bible, because it actually translates the word as redeemer. The NRSV, I think, uses the word kinsman. Some use the phrase kinsman redeemer. It's a little clunky, but redeemer as the noun or redeem as the verb get used 21 times in Ruth 3 and 4. So that tells us that that's a pretty significant theme that's going on in those chapters. And so that redeemer comes, chooses that that other family redeemer does come, Boaz. You know, there's these cultural things that, you know, with these marriage customs that don't make sense to us. And we don't say, well, that's what, we should return to that or anything. That's not what it's about. It's simply, there was a different way of constructing this life together than we would hold now. But what we try to do is understand. And then Boaz, though, cares Ruth. And while that other redeemer is not, with the other family member, is not willing to redeem, be the redeemer, Boaz is. So that's the redeemer. And then the functional significance of personal details in Ruth 4, it's worth noting a few things. So one thing that's, before we get to verse 10 in Ruth 4, it is worth noting in verse 7, where it says, in Israel, in former times, this was the practice regarding redemption and exchange to confirm any such matter. A man would take off his sandal and give it to the other person. So what that tells us is that's not just weird for us, because that's what Boaz does to confirm this deal with the other redeemer who is not willing to take on Ruth and Naomi and everything else. To seal the deal, to sign the contract, he took his sandal and handed it to him, which is like, that's weird. But what this tells us, this remark in the book of Ruth, it was even odd and antiquated by the time the book of Ruth was communicated. It had to be explained in there as well, which then tells us that this is a story that is trying to tell something further back than when it was written. So this wasn't like the daily news that they were trying to write down. And then we have this description of Ruth in chapter 4, verses 10 through 12. And also Ruth the Moabite, the wife of Mahlon, I've bought to be my wife, to preserve the dead man's name for his inheritance, so that the name of the dead man may not be cut off from his brothers or from the gate of his hometown. Today you are witnesses. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord grant that the woman who is coming into your household be like Rachel and like Leah, both of whom built up the house of Israel. May you be fertile in Ephrathah, and may you preserve a name in Bethlehem. And may your household be like the household of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the children that the Lord will give you from this young woman." So that's the connecting Ruth and Boaz then with these other figures that we've touched on up to this point in the story. And again, what's so important for us to note is that we have this Moabite Ruth and this Israelite Boaz. And while the only thing from the book of Ruth that the story doesn't include is the little genealogy at the end. So actually, I think I'm going to preach on the genealogy this weekend, because we see that what happens is the child that comes from Boaz and Ruth is an ancestor of David. And then we all know that David is an ancestor of Jesus. And so God's family tree includes an Israelite, no surprise, and a Moabite, which is stunning. So what might that tell us about God? About any efforts we think about towards purity or things like that?
Inclusive?
Absolutely. You can talk in your small groups. You know, what does this tell us about who God welcomes? How God works? That God's own family tree includes a Moabite. And then what might be the implications for us today? I hear yesterday there were elections. We live in a time and a place where we're told that if someone doesn't agree with us, they are simply the enemy. And we are supposed to demonize them. $44 billion, I think, was what was spent nationwide on political ads. And how many of those were spent demonizing others, saying, "We are good, I am good, this person is bad, and ne'er the twain shall meet"? And so what might the implications be if we have an Israelite and a Moabite who would be predisposed to saying, "We are good, you are bad," and yet here they are coming together to be a part of God's family tree? Maybe that tells us something about how we can shape our lives and live in the world today. So, we're going to be done. Cindy?
I'm confused that they were married for 10 years and neither Orpah nor Ruth had children.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Boaz married her when he didn't have to for sex. And then she got pregnant. So do you think that was God intervening they were married 10 years and didn't have children, and that
Well, you could talk about that in your group. That's one of those questions that the text isn't interested in answering, which doesn't make it a bad question at all, but it's simply one of those questions that we have, which are legitimate, that the text probably isn't, and that's where you can do some midrash with your small group and say, well, let's talk about that. What might this say? What do we know about God that might bring to bear, or how do these details play out? So great question. Thanks, Cindy. All right, enjoy your time together. Have a great week.